This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1971, C.P. Ellis and Ann Atwater were asked to sit down together to solve the problem of school desegregation in Durham. And at the time, no signs pointed to that being a good idea. C.P. was a Ku Klux Klan leader, Ann was a black community organizer, and they were enemies. They even wanted to kill each other. Yet despite all of that, their collaborative efforts and unexpected friendship catalyzed lasting change, and the story has now hit the big screen.
Ann Atwater.
Last night, an electrical fire destroyed East End Elementary School.
Mama, where are we gonna go to school now?
Mama gonna find you somewhere real nice to go.
Not gonna have black kids going to temp school.
Oh, come on. They're gonna put them somewhere.
Mississippi putting it down. I'm the hottest round.
We gonna beat school segregation once and for all.
Listen to me now. I'm
like, you better get your ass down to City Hall tonight. Mm-hmm. Who's next?
The Best of Enemies, starring Taraji P. Henson and Sam Rockwell, premiered in Durham last week, hits the theaters around the country early next month. And it's one of the many topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, a recurring series connecting culture and context. Joining me now for all that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Natalie, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Frank. How you doing?
The film The Best of Enemies, based on that 2007 book by Osha Gray Davidson. Tell us a bit more about the story, Mark.
You know, it's a fascinating story, right? It's a story that's really about when Durham begins to change and shift. So you have Ann Atwater, who is a hardcore in love with her community. I think to call her an activist is almost not to fully capture who she was. I mean, just someone who loved black folks and wanted the best for them and acted within that context. And she's in a situation where Durham has to desegregate. And on the other side of that, of course, is C.P. Ellis, quote unquote, the Klansman. And the movie, like the book, is really about, how the two of them really generate a friendship that helps to transform the city of Durham.
And they're thrown together by virtue of a process known as the charrette, which is the way they decide to solve things in Durham, and that is to put two people together who are diametrically opposed, put them in a room and say, you and your friends, figure this out,
work it out.
And don't come out until you're done, which is how it is that they actually got together in the first place. Let's listen to a clip from the new film that highlights the early dynamics of that relationship between Ann Atwater and C.P. Ellis.
That gun don't belong here.
I like to have it close in case I need to do my talking for me.
This here does the talking for me.
I have a Bible.
Oh, you do? Have you read it?
Of course I read it. And we go to church on Sundays.
Well, then you ought to know, C.P.
Know what?
Same God made you, made me.
Clip from the new film, Best of Enemies. The Best of Enemies from director Robin Bissell, starring Taraji P. Henson, Sam Rockwell, based on a book by Osha Gray Davidson. And I'm talking about it on Back Channel today. Natalie, the film had its Durham premiere last week, hasn't opened in the public. What strikes you about this story itself?
Well, what I thought about when I watched the trailer, and I look forward to seeing it, is that it really reminded me of how black women basically came to the rescue to, help make sure that Roy Moore was not elected in Alabama and got Doug Jones in. And it made me think about the emotional labor that black women often do on behalf of the community when it comes to just trying to make sure that black folks are okay. And it is a narrative that I think, I feel torn about, because on the one hand, as Mark said, it's a pretty incredible story. It's a true story. So, we have to contend with that. But on the other hand, when I think about what Hollywood likes to sort of give a green light to, it's this type of story, where there is this sort of race redemption message at the end. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a little torn.
Well, what about that, Mark? Because even the trailer itself, as we say, it hasn't been nationally distributed yet, but that has gotten pushed back for that very reason. Here we go again.
You know, I think, you know, to give Robin Bissell some credit, you know, he's a first-time director. It was a labor of love for him. He wrote the script for it because he didn't want to have to pass on that story to somebody else. I think the film manages not to be Green Book or Driving Miss Daisy. There are always going to be some qualms about the redemption narrative to it, right? The stories about race that seem to drive Hollywood, in the end, are films about the redemption of former white racists. You know, whether it's the driver in Green Book or Miss Daisy or a range of other folks, you know, and that's a little different than the white savior, right? So you get that narrative also. I think there's something much more authentic about the transformation piece. What bothers you is that the transformation occurs in a two-hour period in ways that doesn't feel authentic, or at least less authentic.
And it's only one person. But let's talk about this, too. Empire star Taraji P. Henson plays Ann Atwood on the film, and she sat down with the News and Observer last week when she was in town for the Durham premiere. Let's hear a clip from that conversation.
One of the co-creators and producers of Empire gave me this script when we shot the pilot, and I was like, wow, did this really happen? He's like, yeah, it's a true story, Google it. And I Googled it, and yeah, there it was. And, you know, as, you know, we just started the show, scheduled conflict, so we couldn't get it going. Then the election in 2016 happened, and I noticed the climate started to change. It looked as if history, we were going backwards. So I called Danny, and I said, we have to make this movie, and we have to make it now. And so I was bold enough to do two movies in my 2.5 month hiatus. But it was that important to me.
I appreciate Taraji, you know, for her desire to tell the story. Apparently she was in touch with Ann Atwater before she passed away. You know, I think Ann Atwater is the type of character that I would love to see more films done about, and not the exceptional part of their story, right? Because Ann Atwater's story, I mean, she was a single mother who was barely scraping by and actually quit her domestic work job, you know, to become an organizer. That by itself, I think, warrants, you know, a film. And I guess, you know, I'm going to keep pushing this theme that at some point, it would be nice if Hollywood would support the types of films that tell the stories of everyday Black people. Not the exceptional part of their story, but just their, just let us see, you know, a microcosm of their, of Black life. And let that be, you know, powerful enough and compelling enough to have a story made about it, a film made about it.
You know, what I think is also important about the film, and I've talked a few times with producer Beth Hubbard, who's worked on some other films, about this particular film. She grew up in Durham as a white woman, you know, close to the Duke family, and knew Ann Atwater because her mother knew Ann Atwater. And, you know, it's a character in a film that really pushes back against certain kind of notions of respectability. Ann Atwater was a big, loud Black woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are folks who are going to watch her and watch Taraji in this role who are going to be uncomfortable with those images, right? But the fact of the matter is, it's not the kind of perfect, say, Rosa Parks type figures who always move the needle. Some of the folks who move the needle are folks that we're going to be uncomfortable with because they don't fit into some nice little paradigm of what a Black heroic figure is supposed to be.
Yeah, that's true.
I want to switch gears now and talk about the latest news. Jussie Smollett's story earlier this week, prosecutors dropped charges against the actor for an alleged hate crime hoax. This story keeps changing and dramatically every moment. Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, and others caught by surprise. Mark, what's going on?
So, you know, the charges get dropped, and I think that's as it should be in the sense that this was a story that was always much ado about nothing. The fact of the matter is that these are the type of things that occur all the time to black and brown and queer and trans bodies, and there's very little attention to it. What makes us upset is that, you know, a situation like this actually takes attention away from that. When I think about the young black woman activist in Columbus, Ohio, who's been missing, had been missing until January, whose body they just found, you know, in a case of domestic violence, the Jussie Smollett story takes away from us actually being able to have a conversation about that in this particular instance. And quite honestly, if, you know, we didn't have this elaborate story of some white guys with a MAGA hat, right, which then made it important to political reporters, you know, we would not have paid much attention to this story.
I was just going to say, you know, it kind of makes sense that charges would be filed, Jussie would be prosecuted, and then charges would be dropped in Chicago. I mean, that's just all the stuff that has been going on in Chicago, you know, for decades, but certainly in the past 5 to 10 years, you know, that there's just so much that, so much, I can't think of the word, but it's not fraud. It is
corruption.
Corruption. Mm-hmm. But fraud might be in there as well.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
It's a form of corruption.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just, it doesn't make sense, but I totally agree with Mark that it this type of thing, I'm sure, like, I don't know for a fact, but I'm sure it happens all the time. Certainly Jussie is, he has more proximity to wealth and power than the average black person or brown person does. But I'm not sure that that is what is happening, that that's what's in the mix in this particular moment. So,
and let's not take Rahm Emanuel off the hook.
You know,
he has not said a mumbling word about any of the police shootings in his city,
but
felt the need to speak out in this case.
Yeah.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, this edition of Back Channel. Just ahead, a controversial HBO documentary takes on abuse allegations against Michael Jackson. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. There was no one quite like Michael Jackson. The pop star sold hundreds of millions of albums around the world, won more than a dozen Grammys, and fundamentally transformed our understanding of performance. So what happens when a shadow is cast over a figure of that magnitude? Renewed sexual abuse allegations against the pop icon are outlined in a new two-part HBO documentary called Leaving Neverland.
He just came across as a loving, caring, kind soul. It was easy to believe that he was just that.
Out of a storybook, right? Out of a fairy tale.
Hello, Wade. Today is your birthday, so congratulations. I love you. Goodbye.
There's no thoughts of this is wrong or anything like that.
He told me if they ever found out what we were doing, he and I would go to jail for the rest of our lives.
HBO's Leaving Neverland came out earlier this month, stirred up a lot of controversy. Still with me for this edition of Back Channel are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark is James B. Duke Professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and host of the webcast Left of Black. So, Leaving Neverland, two-part documentary, 4 hours of total runtime. It tells the story of Jimmy Safechuck and Wade Robson, two men who say Michael Jackson sexually abused them when they were boys. Natalie, tell us about your reaction to this.
Well, first of all, Wade and what's
Jimmy
the,
Jimmy
and
Safechuck,
Jimmy,
yeah.
They're white dudes, first of all, which I think is, you know, just kind of makes the whole narrative fraught with and muddied because of race. There's, you know, just even the history of white people falsely accusing black people, you know, the specter of that kind of raises its head. So when I first watched it, I was really trying to figure out, do I believe these guys? Are they telling the truth? I have to say that I believed one more than the other, and I'll reserve, you know, I won't say which one I did, but I think what was most striking to me was just how these parents of Wade and Jimmy were positioned in the film, and the fact that for once white parents are questioned, and people wonder, what in the world were you thinking about? Yeah. Why would you put your children in a situation, and I'm talking about young children, 7, 8, 9 years old, in a situation where they're in bed with a man, whether you think he would do something or not. So, you know, I believe that something was going on. I don't know what. I think Michael, you know, clearly was struggling with a whole range of issues. But I think, you know, there's something about there's like a sterility to this documentary, in spite of what I've said about like who I believed, that also really makes it sort of difficult to reckon with what actually happened, like, and to really kind of come to a conclusion about whether or not what these young men are talking about and saying and accusing Michael of is real.
Mark, there's a racial dynamic, certainly, but the power dynamic is also clear. What happens when adults abuse children? What happens when somebody with power, if it's a male, is accused by a woman? That's the other dynamic, and there are some quintessential elements of child abuse, repressed memories, and all of that that also run through this story, if not the film.
There's no question that in Michael Jackson's public persona was that of someone that you would not believe as being capable of being a predator. In some ways, if you actually are a predator, that's a way to be successful at it. If we're going to be honest, you know, and this is from a black community standpoint, you know, there were folks who had articulated this discomfort, you know, particularly you look at black comedians in the early 90s, you know, folks like Eddie Griffith, you know, Chris Rock, Martin Lawrence, folks like that. They were all, in comedic ways, very critical and suspect of these relationships that Michael Jackson had, particularly with young white men. It seemed strange and unusual to us, and many of us were coming from households and parents that would caution us about those kinds of relationships, which we can only imagine was also the case with Michael and his close family. You question why 10 years after his death. You always question motivations in this case. You know, in the case of something like Surviving R. Kelly, you know, part of the motivation is that this man needs to be in jail, right? And this is something that may to do this.
Right.
It's a little murkier, you know, with Neverland in that context.
Well, part of it is that the catalog is still out there. People are still going to be making money. And should we make a choice? And that'll be, I think, maybe we'll talk about that in a second. Like, what do we do about the catalog? And do we mute, you know, because we don't like what
Michael,
do we separate the artist from the individual? But the relationships, why you would repress a memory, why you would not come forward in the moment as a child and maybe later as an adult. I mean, I think that what the film tries to do is show how deep this relationship was, and for a young person enthralled with this, not only a star, but anybody who'd pay attention to them. I mean, here's a clip from the documentary, archival film that's in the documentary, of a young Jimmy Safechuck interviewing Michael Jackson on a plane. And, of course, they point out that Michael Jackson didn't give interviews. So here's Jimmy, gets an interview. Of course, he's been on stage with him several times. Let's listen to this.
How did you like Hawaii? What was your best thing?
My best thing about Hawaii? Being with you.
How do you feel about performing and stuff? Do you like it?
I love performing. It is the greatest thing in the world because I feel at home on stage. I could live on stage. I'm the most happiest when I'm on stage and when I'm with Jimmy Safechuck. But the best commercial of all the Pepsi commercials is the one that you and I did. And I'm not just saying that. That's the best one. Because it has heart. Every time I see it, it makes me smile. And I hope to be you all's friends for a long time.
There it is, a clip from the new HBO documentary Leaving Neverland. Details sexual abuse allegations against Michael Jackson. Talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And of course, there has been massive backlash against this, Mark. I mean, the idea, I'll start with you and talk to Natalie. I mean, this fan base is big and they don't want to hear it.
That's been the thing that's been rather astounding to me. The extent of the pushback from his fan base It seems organized. Dare I suggest that even Sony may be involved in helping to better equip them in what has been seen to be a very deliberate and organized response to the film because of what it represents in terms of a threat to the archive, to the catalog. But this is the thing. You know, Michael Jackson was an unprecedented artist, right? We've never seen that level of fandom. Right, we could talk
worldwide.
About Elvis. Right, we could talk about Elvis Presley in the 50s and 60s, but that was American, you know, context. We could talk about Beyonce now, but it does not have quite the global reach that Michael Jackson has. Michael Jackson didn't need American audiences in the 1990s simply because of what that fan base looked like globally, and folks are attached to that music and the memories in very kind of specific ways. I mean, you're talking about, you know, literally maybe three or four generations of folks in which Michael Jackson's was the soundtrack of their youth, of their best moments and their memories of being children. And we have very few examples of artists who had that kind of cultural imprint.
Right. You know, I think that one of the things that is most effective about the documentary is the fact that there's like social media posts, there's YouTube videos and things of that nature that where fans of Michael are, you know, basically tearing down Wade and Jimmy, right? And it rang true to me. You know, it reminds me of what happens to sexual assault victims when they challenge and accuse their predator, you know, the people who prey upon them. So that felt very real to me. And it is a part of why in the end, I felt like, you know what, there's something here. There's something to this. Something happened. And you know, it may have very well happened exactly the way these men are talking about it. But yeah, I think this issue of fandom and you know, the fact that It's to a person, from R. Kelly to Bill Cosby to Michael Jackson. Like, all, we don't want to separate ourselves from the memories, from the nostalgia, from the sentimentality that we attach to these artists and their music or their, you know, whatever their gift is, the television shows and what have you. And we, you know, that is really problematic. We have got to figure out a way to compartmentalize how we feel about an artist and what they have contributed to our lives, and then also be able to like look objectively at information that says, yeah, but they might have been amazing on the Cosby Show, but they're a predator. Here's the evidence, and you've got to reckon with that. And we don't seem to be able to do that in this culture.
And that's where questions of restitution occur. Like in the case of R. Kelly, it's a little clearer. Part of the restitution is you perhaps going to jail, right? For Bill Cosby, that is part of the restitution.
Right.
What does the restitution look like for Michael Jackson, who's no longer here?
Right.
What kind of responsibility does the estate take in this context? And what kind of responsibility should the estate take when the estate is also responsible for a range of family members, right, that the estate there is to take care of, you know, most importantly, his children,
yeah,
right, immediately in that context.
Right,
because this thing does become a corporation at some point, and it lives on beyond the artists themselves.
Right.
And so I think this is one of the questions, and to your point, Natalie, and I want to put this to you, I mean, this whole question of identity, both the identity of the fans, I mean, Michael Jackson certainly changed the relationship between a fan and the artist in ways that I don't think we've ever seen.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson had a problem with his identity. He didn't know who he was. He changed his face. He changed his body, right, in order to be the one thing he only wanted to be, which was a performer.
Yeah.
And he says in that tape clip and elsewhere, the only time I'm happy is when I'm performing, being somebody else. His fans are the same thing. We've checked our reason somewhere else, and the only time we're happy is when Michael Jackson is looking into our eyes and entertaining us.
It also, I think, challenges our beliefs around family, right? Because I think it was easy for any of us to say, we don't know any black parents that would leave their 7 or 8 year old child to sleep in a bed with Michael Jackson, right?
Yeah.
But by the same token, we know that there are black parents who chose to leave their daughters with R. Kelly. And so that speaks to what happens when the fandom is not just about the child, but these parents, the mothers in particular, were just as invested in having Michael Jackson's attention. And the thing that sells it for me when you talk about him as someone who could manipulate people was the way that he manipulated the mothers in relationship to the children and their fathers.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Right. So their mothers felt like they were getting a level of attention from Michael that they weren't getting from their husbands.
Yeah. And right. Michael, yes, very much so. I mean, there is a wedge that very clearly gets established between the family and the father. And now the mother sees
and
Michael.
Both of the fathers who've killed themselves.
Yeah.
I want to switch gears again. In the throes of March Madness, a good time to review the recent Netflix film about basketball. High Flying Bird, from director Steven Soderbergh, tells the story of a sports agent who hatches a plan to take on the NBA from the inside. Let's start with a clip from the film. Here, a young agent is talking to his mentor.
They aren't built for change. None of them. The owners, the Players Association, the firm is just a siphon. Smallest shift in the system, everything gets f***ed up. Player gets hurt, his life is f***ed. Team owner says Negroes, his life is, well, annoying, but more effectively, his players get f***ed. And I'm sitting there looking star in his face, and he's acting like the life of that company is going to be worse off than some of these players that's about to go back to. I'm just saying, man.
Look. There's a reason why the NBA started integrating. As the Harlem Globetrotters exhibition started going into national control, they wanted the control of a game that we played better. They invented a game on top of a game. Question is, what you gonna do?
Clip from the Netflix movie High Flying Bird, starring Andre Holland as Ray Burke, the agent trying to upend the system during an NBA lockout. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel today. Mark, what's your take on this film?
I wish there were more films like this being made. You don't have to spend $15 million. Get a good script written. Get some quality actors. Andre Holland is brilliant.
Yeah, he is.
In this film.
Really, really good.
And tell an important and timely story. And that's what the film does. You know, we think about NBA players and the amount of wealth, and I always go back to the last lockout with the NBA and thought about how powerful it would have been for the Kevin Durant and LeBron James and a young Kyrie Irving who hadn't even played a game in the NBA yet to go back to the spirit of the Negro Leagues, where they took their talent and they barnstormed around the country playing who would ever want to play them, including white major leaguers who they couldn't play formally with. Right, but they played with on the side and splitting the gate, you know, not going through promoters and owners, but taking, you know, that's how they made a living. And you see the power of that in the film where you have these two point guards, right? One who's not played a game and one who, you know, has been in for a year. They're going to be teammates. And the amount of attention that was brought to them just playing a one-on-one game. And the question comes up, wow, what if we control that?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you know there's a spirit of that now, particularly around college basketball, because you have these incredible talents. Zion Williamson is an incredible talent. Duke needed Zion Williamson. Zion Williamson did not need Duke.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. But he didn't have that option, right? He had to come to Duke or someplace, could have been Kentucky, right, in order to, you know, do what he needed to do to get into the league. And the film is gesturing towards a future where the players themselves, right, can have much more control and power over their image and also what they generate in terms of income.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the clip that you played is like the most salient part of it. It's like one of the best things that comes from the film, because it really lays bare, you know, what seems to be at the heart of how the NBA develops this game on top of a game, right? And taking what black people, black men on courts in neighborhoods throughout the country are able to do effortlessly in a lot of instances. Not that they don't work hard, especially once they do move into professional and semi-professional spaces. But the point is that this is an effort to control.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, you know, with the players, the rep from the Players Association, and then, you know, the coaches, the owners, like there's this whole mechanism in place to control what these players are able to do. And so I love that this film really suggests that, you know what, we can beat this game that's on top of our original game at its own game.
Well, the star of the show, Andre Holland, was talking about just that very thing on WNYC's The Takeaway.
I hope that the film doesn't feel prescriptive or didactic, right? I don't think we're trying to ask anybody to think or feel or do anything in particular. I think the film started with a question that Steven and I were interested in engaging with. You know, that question being, what if these black players took ownership of this, you know, industry? And what I hope is that people are willing to also engage with that question and sit with it. And I don't know what that'll lead to or not lead to, but I think the engagement with the question for me right now is enough.
Andre Holland, the actor starring in the Netflix movie High Flying Bird about an agent trying to upend the system during an NBA lockout, talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And to some extent, this is not just basketball. This is the entertainment industry, right? I mean, it's almost what we were talking about before. Michael Jackson is a powerful entertainer, but he's got some real serious limits placed on him by a recording industry and a video industry and all of the rest. Yeah, what if we could control these things and didn't have to shoehorn ourselves into these?
It's so funny. I heard someone make the point that, you know, for these 2 weeks in March and that first week in April, the advertising money that the NCAA tournament generates far outpaces the Super Bowl, right? And we always think about the Super Bowl as the holy grail.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Of sports advertising. At some point last weekend, NCAA, you know, had a little tweet where they're like, guess what? All of the players get free Wi-Fi for the weekend. And Jay Billis, right, the Duke alum and lawyer and ESPN commentator, quickly made the point. It's like, and what do you get from them?
Right.
You know, talking about. And so at least in the Super Bowl, we know that some of this money that's being generated actually gets funneled back literally to the salary of the players, right? We may have a qualm with how much of it should go to them, but at least we know some of it does. In the case of these college players, they're not seeing any of this money.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, we're talking about a lot of things today on this edition of Back Channel, and there's more to come. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia on Back Channel today, recurring series connecting culture and context. Still with me, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and a teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is the James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Let us now talk about some music. Earlier this year, Grammy Award-winning artist and singer India Arie released her first full-length studio album in 5 years. It's called Worthy, and let's listen to one of the tracks from the album. It's called Roller Coaster.
Every time I turn on the news, I can't seem to tell a lie from the truth. Earthquakes all over the place. Contaminated water in Flint is so crazy. Big pharma making big gold bucks. Selling all these deadly and addictive drugs. And we don't even know what we can eat. We got genetically modified broccoli. And they cloning animals, we eating the meat. The next thing they turn around, they cloning you and me. The way they do the human race is a ridiculous crime. And Colin Kaepernick's knee got y'all losing your minds. Come on.
A little bit from Roller Coaster by India Arie. The new album is Worthy. I'm talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, what do you think?
Well, you know what? I just have to say that it's taken me a while to really come around to appreciating India Arie because she is just so. She's not like glitter and sparkle, and you know, she is very much so herself. She just is very sincere and earnest, and I think, you know, that has certainly in my younger years, like I really just couldn't appreciate what she was trying to do. Now that I have a little bit of wisdom, I recognize that wisdom in her, you know, and that she's been wise for a long time. And she has such a loyal fan base, She's making an impact. It's a very quiet one. You know, mm-hmm. She's doing it very much so off the radar. But I wonder, I kind of feel like this album in particular, because it seems to be a little more slick than some of the other albums that she's put out, she may be moving towards another Grammy nomination, because I think it's going to make an impact in a way that, perhaps people are not going to really anticipate.
Mark?
There was a point in time 15, 16 years ago where NDRE was far more important to R&B. You know, and R&B as a genre has not been good to allowing women within the genre to both grow up and also to mature, right? In fact, the genre pretty much dispenses of them, after a certain age. What you realize with this album, and it's part of what Natalie just said, is that, you know, there is a place for NDRE because she has an audience, and what she has represented in terms of an image of a style of music still resonates for some people.
Yes.
The fact that, you know, my 16-year-old had her phone connected to the Bluetooth in the car a couple of days ago, and she was listening to I Am Not My Hair, a song that came out when she was 4 years old. So the fact that 12 years later, this particular moment in NDRE's career still resonates for her, speaks to the fact that this is someone who made music that is connected to multiple generations. And as long as she's able to have the capacity to make the music that she wants to make, because that's the thing where she is now.
Yeah.
Right. She's not answering to record labels.
That's right.
She's at a moment where she can make exactly the kind of music that she wants to make, and she can look
exactly the way she wants.
There's no record company A&R person dictating what clothes she should be wearing, whether or not her hair should look this way. You need to sing this song produced by this producer.
That's right.
She's well beyond that.
Yeah, but she always seemed to be pushing against that, even when she first started.
Right. Yeah, that was a critique of the industry.
Well, you talked about her earnestness too, and that is something that has followed her. And now when she talks about this album, Worthy, and she has been thinking about unworthiness for a long time, and she talked about this, actually the concept of this coming dating back to an interview she did years ago with Oprah. Let's hear what she has to say. Here's a clip of her talking on New York radio station 103.9.
She asked me, how long had unworthiness been my calling card? And what I realized is that a calling card is something you give to someone else. What I gathered from that is that she was saying, how long had my part of my public image been about being a victim? Because we were talking about the Grammys and the Grammy snubs and the industry stuff and all that. I heard her. And so that day I decided I was going to dive into the spiritual power of that word.
NDRE talking about her new album, Worthy, on New York State radio station 103.9.
Yeah, so when I listen to NDRE talk, and that I haven't heard a lot of her interviews, but this is one that really resonates. And then I love what she did with Mark and Michaela Angela Davis on Being Mary Jane before that show went off the air. You know, she is a very critical, thoughtful person. You know, her mind is working. She has been processing, her place in the culture in particular, but also her place as a Black woman, like what that means in particular. Very interesting interchange between her and Oprah. Like, we could talk about that. But I think that part of what draws me to India, particularly at this point in my life, is that I feel her. You know, like, I really understand this process of thinking about, what is this victimization? What is this unworthiness? How do you address that? How do you reconcile that and get over it, right? And get to a point where, an Oprah Winfrey is not asking you about unworthiness being your calling card. And I think that's what I hear in Worthy, is a woman walking in her power, a woman who is clear about who she is and is not fretting about what the culture thinks about her. She is being her authentic self. And when you get to that point, like, I mean, that there's nothing better. And you hear it in India Arie's most recent work.
All right, a new documentary out, PBS series American Masters series takes on the legacy of Sammy Davis Jr. It traces his career and search for identity through multiple decades, features a number of photographs from his personal collection and footage from his performances. Let's talk about this film and the career of Sammy Davis Jr., who's somebody we haven't thought about or heard about in a while. Mark?
We forget. Yeah. You know, the fact that he was only 64 when he died.
Yeah.
And really pre-internet. we forget who this man was. I mean, starting his career when he's 3 years old, what he did on stage as a dancer, as a singer, in film, on television, the breakthrough in terms of Las Vegas. I mean, we forget. You know, Michael Jackson doesn't exist.
Without Sammy Davis.
Well, Sammy Davis Jr. Yeah. I mean, we're talking four or five generations of folks who've been able to be these kind of multi-talented. You know, put Will Smith in that camp. You know, none of those folks exist without Sammy Davis Jr.
As much as Sammy Davis Jr. frustrates me for his racial politics, at the same time, it is undeniable what Mark just said about how generations of entertainers don't exist without Sammy Davis Jr., but also as just like a child who, not a child, but I guess a fan of archival film, to see a three-year-old Sammy Davis Jr. performing as if he is an adult. And to know that he was doing that at a time when there was a Louis Armstrong in the world, there was a Duke Ellington in the world, there were all these amazing, his genius was available to us, to the culture for decades. And he spans time where, things are changing rapidly. So it's really, he is such a complicated and nuanced individual. And I really appreciate what Mark said about how we forget about him, because he died before we could really sort of rehash who he was on social media, on YouTube right. and so forth. But I'm sure we could go there and find him now.
Lacking a formal education.
Yeah, right? But through it all, through those decades, all that talent, he was haunted by the specter of ultimately fading out. I mean, here's a clip from the film.
He could jump so high, jump so high.
That's my fear, that I'll wind up like Bojangles. The Bojangles in the song. That culmination of different black performers, minstrels that I've known, performers who got hooked on junk, who got wiped out by alcohol, got wiped out by changing of times. I've seen them disappear, great dancers, great stylists. And when I do that number, some nights, I said, oh my God, that's me. That's how I'll be it when I'm 70 years old, man. I'll still be working. I'll be working little joints, and I'll talk about what I used to be, and that'll be the end of it.
That's a clip from the documentary Sammy Davis Jr., I've Got to Be Me. It's part of the PBS series American Masters, talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal.
Natalie described him as complex and complicated. The fact that he literally had his career, and if not his life, threatened for a relationship with a white woman in the late 1950s. How do you come back
from that? Right.
The fact that, he was a hugger and it was his natural instinct to hug Richard Nixon and black folks turned on him and he went into a black space and said, let's talk about this, right? This is who I am. Y'all told me how y'all feel about me.
Yeah.
Let's figure out how we move on to this, right? Because he had receipts, like Belafonte and all these people. He's writing checks for the movement, right? He's not unknown to the struggle of black folks, right? But then he has to answer for this particular moment, and he laments, right?
about what the price was that he had to pay for that, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think I have to say that watching the documentary and seeing the scene that Mark is talking about where he goes, I can't remember the school, but, you know, the black students, like, they boo him. Mm-hmm. And he does not, that doesn't, you know, daunt him. He stays and he says, you know, I would like to sing if you would, you know, if you want me to. And they stand up, they applaud, you know. So it's really interesting that in that moment, there's both the repulsion that the community had towards Sammy Davis, but also the love and the appreciation for that clear, like, undeniable talent.
Yeah, Daniel Caesar needs the right to watch that clip.
Let's talk about Solange's new album, When I Get Home. This is Solange's fourth album. It is at the core of this, a relationship with her home city of Houston. Let's listen to a clip of the song Things I Imagined. Things I Imagine from Solange's new album, When I Get Home. Talking about it today with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony. Natalie?
I just love that song. I love that song. And I love Solange. I mean, I think I saw someone post on either Facebook or Instagram how it is just incredible that Tina Lawson, Beyonce and Solange's mother, you know, birth these two incredibly brilliant women that are, you know, the artists that are so different, you know? And I think that's what I love about Solange, but I think is encapsulated in Things I Imagine, because what she's doing, like, around the beat, right? There isn't really a beat in the song. She's and her pitch, like, she has an ear. She's just really a talented musician.
Solange seems much less interested in songs than she is musical ideas. And one of the things you give her a lot of credit for, you know, a lot of folks heard A Seat at the Table and thought this was like her first album. But, I mean, she had been doing this for a while until she finally found that moment, right, where she could hear the sounds that would be able to allow her to articulate what she wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. The biggest differences between her and her sister is that her sister really thinks in the visual realm. Right, we're much more wedded to the visual of Beyonce with the music than the music itself.
Yep.
Where Solange's, you know, space is the musical. And the fact that you talked about her ear, Natalie, she's listened to so much, right? So you're hearing Stevie's inner vision.
Yes, right.
You're hearing Syreeta Wright's music.
Yes.
You hear an artist, a contemporary artist like Georgia Ann Muldrow, who most folks don't know, for instance, as an example, but someone who's collaborated with Badu and other kinds of folks. You hear her bringing all of these. One of the things they did that was so great with A Seat at the Table, that at some point she curated all the songs that influenced her. And it was Stevie, and it was Alice Coltrane, right? And you hear that same level. And I think she's amped it up a bit on this particular album. And, you know, folks were disappointed when they first heard it. Right, because they were like, you know, it's not a seat at the table, right? But she's someplace else, right? She's not going back to that. Mm-hmm. She's moving forward and what she's heard and what matters to her and what she's willing to represent her music.
Yeah, and I love that point, because I think we often, you know, it's like what we were saying almost about Michael Jackson and, like, all these different artists who have, like, they are troubled, right? And we cannot separate ourselves from or we can't separate ourselves from their music. Mm. But in the case of someone like Solange, you know, we want her to keep doing A Seat at the Table, keep making more music like that. And she is truly an artist in that she, I'm done with that. As Mark said, I think that's so brilliant. She is more interested in musical ideas. Mm. So you cannot stick with the same musical ideas if you are experimenting and exploring and trying to progress in your, you know, in your growth. And that's what I hear in Solange. And it really inspires me to do the same in my own art.
And that is this edition of Back Channel. Natalie Bullock Brown is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal is James B. Duke Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. As always, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.